I'm Dimitri Saeed Shami, and our guest today is Dr. Shireen Rahimi of Light Palace Productions in Miami, Florida.
Shireen, welcome to Ratty Tech Conversations at Florida International University. It's great to have you with us, both as an entrepreneurial resident at the Radcliffe Art and Design Incubator and here on the podcast. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Me too. I'd like you to start by describing your journey from and how you ended up becoming a marine scientist and then transitioning into storytelling with video.
Yeah. So first of all, I'll just say I love podcast interviews because there's no video and I'm so used to video. But when I'm doing a podcast interview, I can do whatever I want. I'm dancing right now. You can't see how goofy I look. So I got my start as an underwater visual storyteller and science communicator when I was doing my PhD at the University of Miami. I'm originally from Northern California, but somewhere along my college studies as an environmental science major, became obsessed with coral reefs and specifically coral reefs in Cuba. So I really wanted to work on coral reefs in Cuba. And so came to Miami. I also, when I got here, kind of realized how incredible this place is. And so I've been here since then. I haven't been able to leave. So I was doing my PhD work on coral reef ecology in Cuba and was going to all these incredible places underwater, seeing all these incredible coral reefs and fish and these people who were having very interesting and living very profound lives in connection with the underwater world. And photography has always been a hobby of mine. And I was like, well, I can't go to these places and not take photographs, you know? And so I always had my camera with me while I was doing my scientific research. And eventually I was encouraged by my advisor at the time, whose name is Dr. Kenny Broad. He's at the University of Miami Abbas Center for Ecosystem Science and Policy. He's also a National Geographic Explorer. And so he encouraged me to apply to a Nat Geo Explorer grant as a young explorer. I applied for the grant for my work in Cuba and I got the money. And I don't know if this was technically allowed at the time, but I spent all the money on an underwater case for my camera because those are very expensive. And so from there, I started shooting underwater and the rest is history.
Wow. So you actually spent your grant on a piece of gear. Our podcast is called Tech Conversation. So you brought it all in with that story. And that is one thing that changes when you start as an amateur loving to take pictures outside and then having to deliver them professionally. You use a lot of equipment. I've seen drones. I've seen all kinds of gear. So this was just the first purchase. You broke the rule and then you've continued ever since. Tell me about technology in the work that you do now.
Yeah, it's so funny. I was always a photographer. And I think what I loved about photography was that it was very minimal. And all I had to do was just take this small camera with me. And it's more about the story than the gear. And so when I started getting into filmmaking, because film was this incredible new frontier for me that incorporated music and rhythm and art and all of these different things into the visual medium, that made it so much richer and so much more powerful in my eyes. And so I was getting started with video. I was like very hesitant. I didn't want to get into video because I didn't want to deal with all the gear. I don't like having stuff and carrying heavy things and feeling like I'm intruding on a community that I'm trying to work with all of this technology, as opposed to just being a human that's trying to connect with them on their terms. But a few years later, I have just as much gear as anyone else in the field. I go to physical therapy all the time to deal with my back pain and like all of the issues that come with carrying heavy gear. But also I think I had to kind of reconcile with the fact that I am a child of Silicon Valley. I grew up in San Jose, California, where technology is a big part of our lives. And so, I mean, it's a big part of everyone's life. I'm pretty savvy at using different technologies, at learning different softwares and stuff like that. So I kind of learned to think of it as a strength as opposed to a burden.
Tell me about the work that you did in Bermuda. When you talked to our students, when you were visiting last time at the incubator, you talked about the reefs there and how special they were because they were less affected by climate change, which was one of the main reasons you were interested in studying corals to begin with. And this animated your your trajectory from working in the labs to wanting to become a storyteller and realizing you had more impact that way. Tell us about how you worked there and what was so special about the reefs.
Yeah, so just a bit more context also on my work. I have a production company in Miami called Lighthouse Productions, and we focus on telling stories about the ocean, usually short documentary films for different organizations and different brands and nonprofits. And so really the point of our work is to tell stories about the ocean in a way that brings people into the conversation around ocean conservation and how we can protect our oceans. Because if we don't see the beauty and if we don't care about it, then we're not going to protect it. And so last year, we were approached by an executive producer in Bermuda who wanted to tell a story about Bermuda's ocean conservation and climate policy advances, like achievements, and really put Bermuda on the map in terms of an island that is might be small, but it has a lot of powerful conservation policies and climate innovations coming out of it, and also a lot of really incredible scientific research being done there. And the point was to create a short documentary that would be screened at COP28 in Dubai, which we ended up doing. We had 3 different screenings. They were immersive. Some of them were immersive 360, which was really cool to see your work really big, underwater visuals really big, and really big venues in 360. But really so we went to Bermuda last year to do that shoot, and it was a 10-day shoot. And some of the coolest parts to me, because I'm a coral reef nerd, was working with the coral reefs there. We dove on the reefs. We also worked with a geneticist there who is sequencing the genomes of the corals in Bermuda, because Bermuda's corals are doing relatively well in comparison with the greater region in terms of their coral coverage and coral health. And part of that is thought to be because of Bermuda's position being in one of the northernmost reefs in the world. So it's like at the further extent of where corals can live, at least shallow coral reefs in the world. And so it experiences generally lower water temperatures. And as climate change progresses, you know, our oceans get warmer and warmer. These corals are a little bit buffered by those impacts in terms of the way that warm water causes corals to get stressed and to bleach. And there are a lot of different factors that go into why Bermuda's corals are healthier than other places, but that's one of them. And I think it was really interesting for us to work with the geneticist who was there, because she was trying to understand, she was trying to sequence the corals, her and her company, which is called Karygenetics, are sequencing these corals to understand what it is about the genetic makeup of these corals that makes them particularly buffered to, or like particularly healthy. And it was just cool to go underwater and film these places where you just like, the water is incredibly clear there, and you just look and there's coral as far as you can see.
It reminded me when I saw the footage that you shared of growing up in Haiti and seeing 30, 40 foot high coral heads that were just teeming with life. And my dad loved the water and he loved the ocean. And as a result of that, I got the benefit of actually getting my open water certification when I was 12 there. And when you visited the incubator, you talked about this balance between being a storyteller and also doing really serious science. And you just mentioned it about how if we don't care about the corals, we're not really going to be able to do anything about it. And this is a big part of why you tell stories about climate change and its effect on the ocean and all our entire ecosystem. How did you cope with starting Light Palace Productions, your company, right at the beginning of the pandemic? I'm sure the timing wasn't intentional. You were already dealing with a pandemic of sorts, dealing with climate change and its effects on sea life. And then here you are starting your company, starting your journey as an entrepreneur, and dealing with one of the worst pandemics we've experienced in our lifetimes.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't ideal to start a company at that time. But also at the same time, because of the pandemic, nothing was happening in person. And so a lot of companies were having a lot of demand for video because they were trying to find different ways to reach their audiences through the internet. And so, you know, when I first started, and I try to say this to as many people that will listen, because I think that the way that my work looks now, it just seems like I get to do whatever I want. And like, it's all fun and like about the ocean. But like when I started, I was doing commercials. Like I was doing work that I did not care about. And that was after finishing many, many years of higher education around science. And suddenly I was doing juice commercials. And, you know, I wasn't loving that work at all, but I knew that I had to do it in order to make money, because that's what a business is like at its core in the system that we have right now today. Like a business is meant to make money. And in order to make that, and in order to buy the gear that I needed, in order to like hire the people that I like, get assemble the team that I wanted to create, in order to create the work that would really position me as someone who only does ocean conservation work, I had to make that money and build that kind of foundation for myself. So in some ways, the pandemic wasn't, you know, it didn't make things easy for sure, like to do productions during the pandemic. There were a lot of regulations and stuff like that. But on the other hand, it was kind of a good time in terms of like the demand for that type of work. And then as far as what you were saying about like why I made that transition from science to filmmaking, was because I, as a scientist, I was doing a lot of work and going to these really remote coastal communities in the Caribbean where no one was seeing what I was doing. No one was hearing the stories of these people who were, you know, either struggling to catch fish because they had to go further and further out into the ocean because there were no more fish left, or the scientists who are out here, you know, like working day in and day out to collect data to understand how climate change is affecting people's livelihoods in these communities. No one was hearing these stories generally, and I had a camera, and whenever I did create films or take photographs, they got way more engagement, way more interest, way more, people were way more excited about the visuals that I was creating than about the science that I was doing. And maybe that says something about me as a scientist, but I think I just leaned into the fact that like I do have a knack for science communication, for explaining science in plain terms for everyday people. And I think that it was kind of a no-brainer for me because there are so many incredible scientists and there aren't as many storytellers. And I think we definitely need both.
And when the two combine, it's a really powerful force. I grew up with National Geographic, but also Jacques Cousteau was like my hero when I was a kid. And I think that deeply influenced my interest in the water. But of course, growing up on an island, that would have been there anyway. But going underwater was not that common back then. And so... Let's talk about the way you leveraged that commercial work that you were doing to hone your storytelling skills, because you weren't trained as a filmmaker. You taught yourself. And I remember you discussing how that trajectory was interesting because you were literally trying to figure out how best to tell those stories that are able to captivate your diverse audiences.
Yeah, I mean, I made a lot of mistakes. I think that a lot of people say like, oh, you don't need to go to film school because there's YouTube now and you can teach yourself. And yes, that's true. I taught myself, but I also, first of all, I'm still learning. And secondly, like, I hope I will forever be learning. And secondly, I made a lot of mistakes. Like, I think that if I had gone to film school, it would have been very helpful, or if I had taken some kinds of longer term workshops. But it's really important, I think, for any artist to learn the rules before you break them. And I think I was kind of like a rebel in some ways in terms of my craft. And so I'm always like breaking rules. And I don't think I necessarily learned the rules before I started doing that. But now, you know, I feel like I've gotten to a point where I understand both to an extent. But yeah, I mean, it's not easy to be self-taught. There's a reason why there are schools for this stuff, but I just wasn't ready to go into, I wasn't ready to put more time into school, and I wasn't ready to like spend more, go into even further debt to do that. So I just kind of jumped in, and like the school of life is a beautiful thing too, you know?
We discovered you, or I did at least, at the incubator through our former entrepreneur resident before you, Lauren Shapiro, and you collaborated on a film together. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Lauren's the goat of ceramics. I love Lauren. Lauren and I were connected through Neil, actually, who is the incubator, right? I'm forever grateful to Neil for introducing me to her. Lauren's a ceramicist in Miami. She's an artist. multidisciplinary artist, I would say, even beyond ceramics. And I love working with Lauren because she's just really brilliant. And she has a very, very good understanding of technology and how technology can be melded with art, and also how technology is developing and how it's going to impact our lives, which I think is really important as an artist. She's super far out. And the first time that we collaborated was on her project called Future Pacific, which was a community-oriented ceramics project where Lauren created cast molds of these coral specimens that had been ethically sourced from scientists, and then brought the community together to cast clay into these molds to create these clay corals, and then place them on these structures, these large kind of architectural ruin structures in this large art gallery space. And then as the corals dried, as that unfired clay dried, it cracked and it fell off of these structures, in kind of mimicking what's happening to corals today on our planet, which is that they are getting stressed and they are dying and they are cracking and they are falling onto the seafloor. So that was a really beautiful project because I was pretty early in my career. I think that was one of the first films about art that I ever did. And so got to be really experimental with it. And it was very collaborative. And we actually eventually ended up going to Mo'orea French Polynesia, which was the field study site of Dr. Nissa Silbiger, who is the scientist that Lauren was creating this art piece in conjunction with, because Dr. Silbiger is a coral ecologist and she does a lot of research on how corals are affected by freshwater on this island of Mo'orea in French Polynesia, which is in the South Pacific. So we all went out there and we saw the corals, and it was all very inspiring. And even now, like I just was in Mo'orea again last year for a National Geographic storytelling grant about Dr. Silbiger's work and also her work with the community, and in an effort to tell stories about the freshwater and increase the awareness of its importance on the island and how policymakers there can do more to protect it.
I remember when Lauren spoke about you, she credited you for teaching her a lot about how to tell stories visually. So you had a big impact on her, not just in terms of doing the filmmaking, but in the way you told the stories around this very sensitive topic.
I'm happy to hear that. I feel like it's really rare to find artists, maybe not as much artists, but especially scientists like Dr. Silbiger, who understand the importance of media for anything, like advancing your work, getting the word out. It's so important because so many artists, I feel, do their work and then it sits in a gallery and no one sees the process of how they did it. No one sees the final product. It's only people that were there. And so I think the artists and scientists that know the importance of bringing people in to tell their stories go a lot further. And so that was really, I really love working with both of them for that reason. They're badass.
You collaborate a lot in your work. I mean, it's a big part of your mission to encourage activism, and that includes brands that align with your mission. Can you talk about the work that you've done with Nautica and Oceana and Dell Technologies and how that's allowed you to have a bigger platform and maybe work with new technologies and expand your scope of both services and storytelling?
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because at the heart of what I do is I want everything that I do to be in the service of reducing harm and encouraging conditions of life for all beings everywhere. That includes humans of every race and creed, animals, the plankton, you know, like everything. We need everyone to be happy. We need everyone's needs to be met, and we need to value each life. And there are certain brands that I could potentially work with where the costs of that collaboration wouldn't outweigh the benefits, right? So like, unfortunately, we live in a system in which not all life is respected. And so I'm pretty careful about which brands I choose to align with. For example, I would never do a collaboration with a major cruise line, because I believe that major cruise companies are some of the biggest polluters on the planet. And there is no way that my collaboration with them would outweigh the incredible harm that they do to people and ecosystems and animals. But it's really great when I do find brands that I do align with, Oceana being a nonprofit partner, so I wouldn't necessarily put them in that category. But Nautica, while they do have you know, while they are like a big brand that creates a lot of objects, which leads to a lot of waste, they're also a great ally and advocate for ocean conservation. They contribute a lot of money to Oceana. They do a lot to enhance awareness around ocean conservation and also highlight the people who they call wave makers in terms of their ambassadors. I am a wave maker myself, who are doing really incredible work for ocean conservation. And, you know, Dell Technologies is a brand that I think has always had a really strong ethical backbone in terms of the way that they package their products and stuff like that. Nautica has a sustainable line, which is really cool. And I will say, like, it's amazing to work with brands. They give me opportunities that I wouldn't have elsewhere. And also, like, it's really important for me because that is how I make the bulk of my revenue. And I wish I was like wealthy and I didn't need money to do this work, because then I would just do everything for free for the people who needed it the most. But I still have to live and like, pay my bills. And so brand work is a big part of that. It's really, really helpful to me in my work.
When you were talking about the reefs in Bermuda, you talked about the use of AI to be able to enhance the storytelling with the reefs, to be able to, for example, show a reef with a specific amount of coral bleaching. Can you touch on the power of the tools that are coming up now to be able to still tell these stories without perhaps impacting the reefs themselves? Because to be there recording the amount of travel time you just talked about, the expense of actually the work that you do and having to, you know, balance the economics of everything as you travel with all of this equipment and having to build teams all over the world. How does AI factor into this, and how does it balance for you in terms of its emergence, both as a really powerful tool, but also one that's scary and one that's definitely using a lot of energy right now?
That was a hard question. I'm still trying to reconcile how much time I spend on planes burning carbon. I don't even know what would happen once it comes to AI. I mean, I think that AI, considering that it is a revolutionary piece of technology, which throughout history, those types of technology have always been used for good and for bad. The ways that we could use it for good in terms of the work that we do is that, you know, we have to use a lot of energy and resources to get out to these places to get footage, really, that shows what these places look like, when instead what we could do is we could have a smaller team. I could go, for example, with a smaller camera that doesn't need as much, that doesn't take as high of resolution footage, for example, get photos of the reef and say, okay, this is what it looks like. Create a 6K raw simulation footage of this reef based on this photo so that we know it's accurate, but actually we don't have to spend as much resources and stuff to get it there. That is one way that I could see that being helpful. I see it as something that's not going to replace the people who are creating the original ideas and the original IP that goes into making a piece of work. I see it replacing the people who are doing the manual labor to bring that idea into reality. And I am not saying I think it'll be better net positive or net negative, but I could see how it could be useful in certain situations.
What advice do you have for young Shireens that are coming up after you in this new world with all of these crazy challenges, but also this amazing technology that is emergent and affected by the stories that you tell that are both critical and hopeful? What do you tell the next generation?
What I usually say is just get out there and start doing the work, because the sooner that you go out with your camera, doesn't matter what camera it is, doesn't matter if it's a GoPro or an iPhone or a $50,000 camera, the sooner you get out there and you start telling stories and sharing them, you'll be getting real world data on what works in terms of your storytelling style and what doesn't, and who resonates with it, who doesn't resonate with it. It's actually incredible. I mean, social media has ruined my life, but it's also given me incredible real-time feedback on the work that I'm creating and the impact that it can have. And that's why I don't usually call myself an artist, because I think artists create work for the sake of creating. And I think as a science communicator, I have a very specific goal in mind. I want to get people engaged with conservation. And so I am always trying to understand like what is a better, more effective way to do that. And I think the best piece of advice I could get is go out there and start creating and start refining your own distinct voice. Because when you do that, you have a unique piece of IP, of intellectual property that no one can take away from you, right? When you put in the AI, like do a rap verse like Eminem, and the AI can do a rap verse just like Eminem, that means that Eminem made something that is very valuable because he created his own distinct voice, his own distinct style, that is something that people want to replicate or to make more of. And I think that's when you really start to benefit yourself and others through your work, is when you're creating, you're offering something that no one else can.
Do you think there's going to be an AI version of Shireen out there in the future, swimming underwater virtually?
I hope so. That would mean I really made it.
So what are you up to next? What are you doing now? And what are you planning? I know you're planning to have some travel soon.
Yeah, so I have a few trips lined up, which kind of conveniently are all close together. April 30th, we'll be going to Bermuda for a couple of days to screen the film. And then I'll be going to Micronesia after that on a Nat Geo expedition as part of a Meridian grant, which is basically a bunch of explorers coming together, a group of explorers coming together. We'll be going there to document the impacts of sea level rise on one of the more remote coral atolls in the world in Indonesia that is being intensely affected by sea level rise, and people there are having to go and to leave, basically our climate refugees. So I'll be leading underwater and photography on that. And then after that, I'll be going to Egypt to work with dolphins in the Red Sea. I'll be hosting a immersive 360 underwater video, a short film basically, about dolphins in the Red Sea that are rubbing themselves on corals, and a scientist who is trying to understand why. After that, I'll be heading to Rwanda for a National Geographic photo camp, where we'll be working with the Sola School, which is a school for Afghan girls, like a boarding school for Afghan girls. We'll be teaching them about photography, and I'll be learning a lot from them, I'm sure. And that's my summer.
Wow. Well, can't wait to catch up with you after you return. Thank you so much, Dr. Shireen Rahimi. It's been a pleasure having you on the Tech Conversations podcast. I'm Dimitri Saeed-Shami. This is my first time hosting. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you in the next episode.